and the couch carcass. I wondered if she ever got to go away overnight like her husband did. She could make up a story and meet me there. She could meet me anywhere. It wouldn't even have to be overnight. It could be more realistic, an hour, 15 minutes. Summer was just about here. The nights would be warm. I thought about how easily she slipped out our first night together, how her husband and kids never even knew she was gone. We could meet in the woods. We could meet in her clearing. We could meet at the old mining office. The front door opened and Elvis ran out. He went straight to the woods without noticing me. Amber stepped out on the porch. She wasn't wearing one of my t-shirts like she usually did. She had on a short, silky red robe. Beneath it, I saw the black lace nightie she had worn the night we had our last big fight. She reminded me of the times Mom put on slinky stuff waiting for Dad to come back from the bars after a bad fight. She only did it when she knew Dad had been right. It was way too early on a Saturday morning for Amber to be up already. Maybe she had stayed out all night, too, and just got home. She had done that twice before. Both times we had a big fight about it. I didn't feel like fighting right now, so I wasn't going to ask. "What are you doing?" she shouted at me. I made myself more comfortable on the couch. "Where have you been?" I ignored her. I was busy thinking about the office. I could clean it out. I could fix it up. I could put curtains on the windows. She came over and snapped her fingers in front of my face. "What is with you? You look stoned. Are you stoned?" She bent over and sniffed me. "Where were you all night?" "I fell asleep in the woods again." "The woods." She rolled her eyes at me. "I swear to God, you are so fucked in the head. Do you know what kind of people sleep in the woods?" "Campers? Psychos," she said sharply. I glanced at the hills. The sun was coming up pink again, spreading a peachy gold stain over the tops of the hills. "Well, while you were off communing with nature last night," I heard Amber go on, "we had a crisis." I sat up. "Is Jody okay?" "Yes." "Misty?" "Yes, they're fine, nothing like that." "The gun, where's the gun?" "I don't know," she said. "Probably where you put it. Harley, what's wrong with you?" She reached out to touch me and I pushed her away. I got up from the couch. "Did somebody call? What day is today? Did somebody call about the house?" "What are you talking about?" "You said there was a crisis." I grabbed her by the arm and shook her. "What's the fucking crisis?" "Harley, stop." "You said there was a crisis. Do you know what a crisis is?" "What's wrong with you? You're scaring me." "Define crisis." "Something bad," she said, breaking into a sob. I squeezed her arms until I saw her skin between my fingers turn white. "The last time someone told me there was a crisis in my house, it was a state trooper standing in Skip's driveway with all those fucking blue lights going everywhere," I shouted at her. "There's been a crisis in your household. Who the fuck talks like that?" I started shaking her again. Her crying went from wild and terrified to steady and defeated, the way it always did with Dad. I never wanted to make anybody feel that way about me. I used to have nightmares about it before I stopped dreaming. She broke free of my grip and walked away, rubbing at the finger welts on her arms. "What did you want him to say?" "The truth," I shouted back. "Why can't anybody ever say the truth? You wanted him to say your mom killed your dad? That would have been better? I wanted him to say your life is going to suck every minute of every day from now until you die. That's what I wanted him to say." She sat down hard on the ground, wrapped her arms around her bent legs, and buried her chin in her knees. "You think you're the only one whose life sucks?" she asked the empty space in front of her. "You think you're the only one who has a right to be miserable just because you have a job?" "I have two jobs. Big deal," she said flatly. "I'd rather have a job than go to school and have to hang around this house pretending to be Mom." I had one of my flashes of brotherly obligation. I wanted to tell her she had her whole life ahead of her, but it would have been like tossing her another white crayon. She straightened out her legs in front of her and started pulling up the grass between them. "What's the crisis?" I asked defeatedly, all my anger and fear spent. She took a deep breath and blew it out through pursed lips. I probably shouldn't have called it a crisis. She lay back on her elbows and arched her neck so she could look up at me. I didn't realize you had a thing about that word. It's not such a big deal, I guess. Maybe it's actually good. Tell me, I said impatiently. I found almost $1,000 in Misty's room last night.
What?
It belonged to Mom. It was her secret stash. She'd been saving up for a long time, I guess.
Secret stash for what?
I guess she was going to leave Daddy. Isn't that wild? I never had any idea things were that bad, did you?
How did Misty get it?
She found it and stole it from Mom. I couldn't get her to tell me anything else. She clammed up the way she does. You know what that's like. I couldn't think straight. Every thought I had ever had about my parents rushed into my brain. Every thought I had ever had about Misty followed. But the one that stayed the longest was the thought of $1,000 sitting in my house for almost 2 years.
How much money? I asked.
$973.54. It was my turn to sit down hard.
Where did you find it?
Do you remember that sunflower shirt you asked me about?
The sunflower shirt. I blinked at her. The blood-stained sunflower shirt was in my desk drawer with Skip's letter and the latest Victoria's Secret catalog.
I nodded. I felt kind of sick. I tried to remember the last time I ate.
Well, you got me thinking about that shirt and how much Jody would like it. It would go perfect with that little wraparound denim skirt she has with the eyelet trim. Right now she wears that old pink shirt of Misty's with the furry white bunny head on it. It's way too small, and the bunny is missing an eye, and it has a mustard stain on it. She looks so Appalachia in it.
I put my head in my hands. I was getting a headache on top of feeling like I was going to throw up.
When Misty outgrows things, she usually gives them to Jody right away. But sometimes she packs stuff in a box in her closet to save for her own kids someday.
I've seen some of it. It's not special stuff like Christmas dresses. It's shit like that Joey Chitwood thrill show windbreaker she got at the fair, and that ratty old t-shirt of Dad's that says, "Old hunters never die, they just lose their bang." Most of it's really old and crappy and weird, so I thought maybe she kept the sunflower shirt.
I looked over at her. So you found the money in a box of old clothes in her closet?
No, when I went in her closet, I found my Easy Bake oven. Do you remember how much fun we used to have with that? Do you remember the King and Queen game? I was the Queen of Hearts and I made you pink cakes.
I remember, I urged her along.
Anyway, I opened it up to look at it, you know, for kicks, and I found an envelope stuffed inside the oven.
I can't believe this.
You were the King of Pain, remember?
She was still reminiscing.
After that one song you liked so much, they used to play it on the radio when we were kids. It was a hit or something. What was it called?
King of Pain, I said. Where's Misty now? I asked.
She's probably still sitting on her bed guarding her money. She stayed up all night doing it. Jody slept with me.
I got up slowly from the ground. The pounding in my head, the sloshing in my stomach, the fear and confusion in my heart were nothing compared to the anger I suddenly felt.
She thinks she's going to keep it? I asked, my voice shaking with disbelief.
Yeah. Amber nodded. That's what she said. Misty was wide awake and sitting cross-legged on her bed, just like Amber said she would be. She had on one of her own nightshirts, a big tie-dyed one that was mostly blue and purple, and the envelope full of money sat in the pouch of material draped between her knees. She gave me an odd, closed-mouth smile when I walked into her room.
I walked right up to her. I wanted to hit her more than I had ever wanted to hit anyone in my life. I looked down at the envelope stuffed with bills and felt like I was going to faint. Her face was a deadly calm mask of superiority.
It's mine, she said. I'm the one who found it.
I couldn't unclamp my jaw to make words.
Where?
I managed to choke out.
In Mom's underwear drawer, she answered me. That's all I'm telling you.
My hand shot out so fast I didn't realize it had left my side until I felt something warm and living in its grip. Misty's head hit the wall behind her bed with a hollow thud. Her hands flew to my hand clenched around her throat, and she started clawing at it with her blue fingernails.
You're going to tell me everything, I said.
Or what?
She coughed, trying to pry my hand free. I let go all at once, as quickly as I had grabbed her, and walked to the other side of the room holding the hand at arm's length in front of me like it might attack me next. I heard her gagging. My hands started trembling. The right one had mean red marks dug into the skin. It already throbbed. I wanted to say I was sorry, but all I could do was stare at the wall. It needed a fresh coat of paint. "You can't do anything to me," Misty said, her heavy stare numbing me from behind. "You can't hurt me. You can't kick me out. You're my legal guardian. You have to take care of me." I couldn't look at her. I didn't want to go near her. I was afraid of myself. "I'm not going to do anything to you. I don't even want you to tell me about the money," I said as calmly as I could. "I don't want to know another goddamn thing about Mom or Dad for as long as I live." I turned around and saw Jody's empty bed. She had taken all her dinosaurs with her. Must have taken them forever to lug them all over to Amber's room. Misty was rubbing her neck. She hadn't changed her position except to take the envelope and push it deeper into her lap. In order to take it from her, I would have to touch her between her legs. "I had to take the money to stop her," she said. "She was going to take us away from him. Don't you understand?" The confession didn't bring any satisfaction into her eyes, but it livened them a little, as if she had begun to eat after days of hunger. "I don't care," I said. I held out my aching hand. "Give me the money, Misty." "No, I don't get it. Even if you don't care about the rest of us, you could have been spending the money on yourself. What are you saving it for?" "College," she said triumphantly. The urge ripped through me again. I imagined slapping her would feel like coming. "Corrupt," flashed across her chest, the letters molding the new little breast bumps beneath her shirt. I shook my head, but the word wouldn't leave. Tears started spilling out of my eyes like blood, calm and steady and without emotion. They tumbled down my cheeks and dripped off my chin and made dark spots on my ShopRite shirt. "Give it to me," I said hoarsely. "It's mine. It's not yours. It's Mom's. She doesn't know you have it, does she?" She didn't say anything. "We'll ask Mom what she wants us to do with it. She can't have any visitors thanks to you freaking out. She can have calls," I said. Misty put her hands on the envelope. "Give it to me now, Misty," I said. "You know I can take that money from you. I might have to hurt you to do it, but I can do it." "No, you can't," Amber announced. Her voice surprised me. She'd been silent the whole time. I had forgotten she was still in the room. "You can't hurt anyone," she added. "But I can." She hauled off and smacked Misty, open-handed, full across the face. The impact threw her sideways off the bed, and the envelope went with her. Amber walked over, picked it up, and left the room waving it at me. Misty glanced my way. Her eyes sparkled with tears in a face full of deliberate emptiness. "She did that because of you," she said. "You brought it on yourself." "No, that's not what I mean. She's not ever going to behave until you take care of her." A chill curiosity kept me from moving. "I want you to take care of her," she repeated. I wanted to get out of there, but her eyes held me the way a stagnant well forced me to stay and drop stones in it. "You'll be happy, and Amber will be happy," she further explained. "Then me and Jody can be happy too. It's hard living with you guys." Her one cheek blazed red. "I just want us to be happy," she said before disappearing into her preferred silence. "That's all." It sounded like a threat. "Don't look at me like that," Amber said when I joined her in the kitchen. "I knew you wouldn't be able to do it. We'd have to spend the rest of our lives trying to get ownership by signing the proper legal documents." She paused and brought her palm to her lips and blew on it. "God, that hurt," she said. I took a stunned seat at the kitchen table. The envelope sat in the middle of it. I'd never seen so much money in my life. "I guess things were worse between Mom and Dad than I thought," Amber said. "If she was going to leave him." I looked over at her. She was pouring water in the coffee maker. She hated coffee. "Are you making me coffee?" I asked. She turned around smiling in her skimpy robe, caught in a lazy shaft of white sunlight coming through the window, holding the coffee pot out to one side like a newlywed in a Folgers commercial.
"Don't you want some?"
She flipped on the machine and came and sat down across from me. "I guess it all makes more sense now," she said. "I mean, what happened?" "It makes less sense," I told her. "Why shoot somebody you're going to leave?" "She couldn't leave, remember? Misty took her money." The brewing coffee smelled great. I wished I had a big greasy breakfast to go with it. Bacon, pancakes, sausage gravy over biscuits, home fries. My stomach rumbled and my dick stiffened a little. I bet Callie Mercer could do incredible things with an egg. "Anyway," Amber sighed, "now I can get my license."
"Huh?
You said we needed $1,000, right?" I laughed at her. "Are you nuts?" Our hands shot out at the exact same moment. I was faster. I scooped up the envelope and backed off from the table. "That's mine," she said, lunging for me. I shoved it into the waistband of my pants. "We need it for taxes on the house."
"What are you talking about?"
$1,100, I explained. "It's due in 2 weeks and we don't have any of it."
"Whose fault is that?"
she cried.
"Fuck you, Amber."
"No, fuck you."
"Hi,"
Jody said, coming into the kitchen, frowning and rubbing her eyes with a little fist.
"What are you guys fighting about now?"
"Nothing," I said. I closed my eyes and slumped back into a chair.
"Nothing to you," Amber shot back.
Jody took a seat at the table and set down her notebook, pen, sparkle three horn, yellowy, and a pink plastic Tyrannosaurus she won at the fair the year before picking a duck.
"You just don't want me to ever get my license," she went on.
She leaned over the table toward me when she realized I was done fighting. I thought she was going to sniff me again. I wondered if she could smell a woman on me.
"Something's wrong with you,"
she said it with authority.
"Nothing's wrong with me. I just don't have the energy for this right now."
I put my head down on the table the way I had seen smart kids do my entire life when they finished their tests early.
"Will you play with me today?"
Jody asked. I heard Amber's chair being dragged out from the table and being pushed in again.
"She's asking you," she said.
"Sure," I mumbled into my arm. "Will you give me a cup of coffee?"
"I'm not allowed," Jody said. "I can only get the cup."
Amber made a persecuted snort and got up from the table. A cupboard door banged open. A plastic mug slammed against the countertop. I heard the click of an off switch and the glug-glug of coffee being poured. The smell pulled my head up. I circled the mug with my hands. The heat felt good. I took the hand Misty had hurt, turned it upside down, and held the scratches over the steam. Across the table, Jody was working on her list. So far, she had written, "Feed dinosaurs, eat breakfast, brush teeth." Amber sat down with a box of Pop-Tarts.
"You know, I was just thinking," she said, ripping open one of the foil packets. "How did Misty know for sure Mom was going to leave Dad? Mom could have been saving that money for lots of reasons."
"We heard her talking about it," Jody volunteered.
"What?"
Amber said. I put down my coffee cup.
"You know about the money?"
Amber asked slowly.
"I think so,"
Jody said without pausing in her work.
"You mean the money Mommy was saving so she could move away from Daddy? She said she had a whole bunch hidden in the house somewhere. Misty said she was going to look for it after we heard Mommy talking about it, but she couldn't find it."
Amber and I looked at each other.
"Who was Mom talking to?"
I asked.
"Uncle Mike."
The pen in the little hand kept moving carefully across the paper.
"He was going to help her out," Jody went on. "He said she had to get Misty away from Daddy before it was too late."
"Too late for what?" I asked, feeling the skin on the back of my neck tighten.
"I don't know,"
Jody answered. She finished writing "Play with Harley" and looked up.
"Misty didn't know either,"
she said. Chapter 12. Skip and I were juniors in high school when that asteroid, 1994 XL1, came within 60,000 miles of hitting Earth. I remembered it happened around Christmas because we had a crappy old wreath Skip's mom had thrown out hanging in the mining office. I heard about it on the news, and before I could call Skip, he called me. We were both blown away by the thought of a 100,000-ton rock the size of a barn exploding above us and flattening the United States. An Earth crosser, one of the scientists on the news called it. An asteroid that cruises through our orbit. The next day I got off the bus at Skip's house and we grabbed a bottle of the rum his mom stockpiled so people could drink her homemade eggnog, and we headed for the railroad tracks. We talked the whole way there about all the cool disaster movie facts. How scientists estimated there were 1,000 doomsday Earth crossers out there that could end life on our planet as we know it. How the dust and smoke from impact would block out the sun for years, and there'd be a nuclear winter and an ice age and giant tsunamis that would drown half the world. How the only safe way to get rid of one would be to explode a nuclear bomb in front of it and nudge it off course without shattering it. But scientists would need 5 months' warning to do it. XL1 wasn't spotted until it was 14 hours away, and it was considered small. We'd see a doomsday about 6 seconds before it hit. Then we built a fire in the snow and got trashed and philosophical. Why go to school if the whole planet could be destroyed tomorrow? Why get a job? Why take shit from your parents? Why take shit from anybody? The only thing we couldn't rationalize away was trying to get laid. Neither one of us had any luck yet. But we instinctively knew it wasn't a pursuit we should give up just because we might only have 6 seconds left to live. We were sure we were the only people around who appreciated the magnitude of what had almost happened. Hardly anyone we knew seemed to care. Not our parents, nobody at school. Even the science teachers didn't get all that cranked up about it. The only person I knew who cared was Jody. She got excited when I explained that a giant asteroid was probably what wiped out the dinosaurs, even though I knew she was too little to really understand. And Skip said Donnie got interested when the news showed a futuristic computer graphic of a comet being made into a steam-propelled rocket by melting its ice core with nuclear power. He howled over that one, saying it was because the comet looked like a flaming zinger. But everyone else went on with their stupid little lives without even glancing at the sky that night. My dad even bitched at me to change the channel when I found a late-night special on asteroids. I tried making him see the terror, but also the relief in knowing we were insignificant as a race, how it made the simplest acts more important and the monumental ones pointless. He sank deeper into the couch and told me I had a better chance of getting hit by a truck than an asteroid, and to give him the goddamn remote. I waited until I was sure he wasn't watching me. Then I snuck a notebook out of my backpack and wrote down the definition of an Earthcrosser. It was probably the only educational thing I had ever done outside a classroom, except for going to the library after Mom's arrest and looking up the differences between homicide, murder, and manslaughter. I wrote, "Chance of a collision is small, but if it did happen, it would occur without warning and could cause total annihilation." Just like the truth about Dad and Misty. I knew it was out there. I also knew if I ever had to face it, my world wouldn't survive. All I could do was ignore it and hope it passed right out of my orbit. In the meantime, I started living my life with a little bit more urgency. I gave Callie Mercer 4 days to call me. I didn't plan on it being 4. It was a random number. But after I made the decision to walk away from the Hot Point dishwasher I was supposed to be loading onto the Barclay delivery truck and got in my own truck, studied another painting and started driving to her house, I realized the number 4 had a lot of significance for me. There were 4 kids in my family. Jody was 4 years old when Mom killed Dad. Skip would be in college for 4 years. We only got 4 channels now that Dad's satellite dish was gone. There used to be 4 basic food groups before the government switched to a food guide pyramid, much to Church's relief. He hated having fruits and vegetables lumped together, and it drove him crazy how eggs used to be with the cheese. Misty had left 4 scratches on my hand. There were 4 empty doghouses in my yard. I now had 4 artists I liked. Pierre Bonnard, Callie's artichoke guy, Francis Bacon, and this abstract artist named Jackson Pollock. He was one of those guys who laid down canvases on the floor and squirted paint all over them. I always thought those guys were idiots until I saw Grade Rainbow. I recognized it right away. The black mess with gobs of gray and squiggly white lines. The smears of rust and fleshy yellow like dried blood and snot. It was the same kind of stuff I used to see in my head when Dad hit me.
I didn't know what Jackson Pollock meant for it to be, but if his own dad had hit him when he was a kid, and that's what he had been trying to show, then he was a genius.
If the painting was really just supposed to be a defective rainbow, then he was an idiot. I decided to give him the benefit of the doubt and hoped his dad had hit him. Callie's dog started barking when I turned in her drive. I was going to go pet them, but I didn't get the chance. She was outside with Zach playing in the sandbox near the house, and she saw me right away. She stood up and brushed sand off her legs and the back of her shorts. She was wearing the pink bikini top. I walked as far as her front door and waited for her, uninvited, in broad daylight, in front of her kid, without an excuse. She crossed her yard, giving me her concerned look, and I realized I was getting sick of that one. I knew it was the same way she looked at Zach and Esme, probably her dogs, too. My mind started racing through all the looks I thought would be better. The way Ashley Brockway had looked at me when I threw her against my truck door. The way Mom had looked at me when I started screaming in the hug room. The way Church had looked at me when I went to put the bananas with the cereal. The way Amber looked at Dad the first time he hit her.
"Is something wrong?" she asked. "Shouldn't you be at work?"
"You said you were going to call me."
"I haven't had a chance," she started to explain.
"Bullshit," I said. She opened her mouth to say something but stopped. I tried to figure out what was the same about all those other looks that made them better. It was fear. Fear that I might hurt her. Fear that I had lost my mind. Fear that I was going to tamper with the universal order of things. Fear that there can't possibly be a God.
"Does your husband listen in on all your phone calls or something?"
I kept at her. "You could have called me any time. You could have said you wanted to talk to me about Jody." Concern vanished, but it wasn't replaced with any kind of fear. Her face paled with anger.
"When are you home, Harley?"
"Huh?"
"When are you home?"
I didn't answer. It felt like a trick question.
"Don't you work two full-time jobs?" she asked.
"Yeah."
My answer enraged her. She fought to keep her anger in check, but I could sense her helplessness. She didn't have much control over her emotions. They seemed to control her like a puppet at the mercy of a hidden hand. My own mom had been more of a bare hand. "The problem is not when can I call you," she said, and took a troubled breath. "It's when can you be there to talk to me?"
"I usually come home for dinner."
"Well, that's just great," she said in a brittle voice. She took a step back and put her hands on her hips. "Dinner time is when I'm cooking and dealing with two hungry, whining kids while my husband sits in the middle of it all, having a drink and bitching about his day. Should I just interrupt him at some point and say, 'Excuse me, dear, I need to call the 19-year-old neighbor boy and see if he'd like to come over later so I can fuck his ears off. Is that what I should do?'" She was yelling at me by the time she finished. She was breathing hard, too. I stared at her breasts moving up and down. There were sweat beads between them. Her nipples were hard. When I looked up again, she was watching me.
"Yeah," I said. "That's what you should do."
She shook her head and made a harsh laugh.
"Do you know what would happen if I did that?
Your husband would divorce you and you wouldn't have to be married to a guy you can't stand?" A menacing stillness came over her. Even her breathing seemed to stop. She was going to explode or she was going to transform again. I wondered what it would be like to be inside her when she had one of her sudden changes of heart. My hand shot out the way it had done with Misty, without my consent, and hooked into the top of her shorts. It yanked her hard and she stumbled into me. I smashed my mouth against hers. She didn't want me doing it. It wasn't the kind of kiss she liked. It was more like a tongue fuck. She got loose and pushed me away.
"What are you doing?"
she gasped, darting a frantic look at Zach in the sandbox. He was busy pouring a shovel full of sand into a dump truck. I grabbed her again, this time around the hips.
She held out her hands and braced herself against my chest, but I could still reach her throat with my mouth. I chewed on her, thinking about Elvis chewing on dead baby groundhogs, and I felt her give a little. I went lower until I was sucking her nipples right through the bikini top. She made one of those shrieking, gasping, moaning noises I thought only little girls made. "Zach," she breathed and tried wiggling away. "He might see us. Let's go inside." "I can't."
"Hey, Zach," I yelled over to him. "I'm going to go inside with your mommy and get a drink. That okay with you?"
"I want Kool-Aid,"
he shouted back.
"You got it, buddy."
I caught her wrist tightly and pulled her along behind me the way Dad used to drag Misty to her room to be punished. I untied her top as soon as we closed the door behind us, and she had her shorts off by the time we reached the kitchen. I laid her out on her glass-topped table and dropped my pants around my ankles. When I pushed inside her, she made that little girl sound again. I pumped away at her. It's all I could do until she started screaming things and gripping me tighter with her legs and her hands. I wasn't sure what to do then, so I pumped harder. I wasn't creative or skilled, but I was diligent. I was pretty sure I made her come. It felt like a bunch of explosions going off inside her flesh. When it was over, I sat down in a chair and left her smiling, with her eyes closed, spread-eagled on the glass. I was drenched with sweat, but I couldn't stop shivering. I pulled Dad's coat tighter. I was glad she hadn't asked me to take it off. Afterward, she was calm as a puddle. She took Zach a sippy cup of Kool-Aid and walked me to my truck. As we were about to say goodbye, she remembered something and went back into the house. She brought me a folded piece of notebook paper. I knew it was a note from Jody before I opened it. "I found this in Esme's backpack," she explained. "She and Jody write notes back and forth all the time, but this one concerned me a little. I thought maybe you should know about it." The words didn't mean anything to me at first. Then they did. I asked Esme about it, and she said it was just Jody trying to gross her out. I heard Callie go on. "Jody comes up with some wild ones. A month or so ago, she and Esme were writing back and forth about brothers and sisters getting married and having babies. I had a little talk with the two of them about that. Jody told me Misty said it was okay. I'm sure Misty was just messing with her mind. Big sisters do that, you know." I kept staring at the note. "Misty killed a kitten once. I suppose this makes me a snitch, but I care about Jody, and Misty too. If this kitten thing is true, it's kind of disturbing." "I'll take care of it," I said, crumpling up the note and shoving it in my pocket. "When can I see you again?" I asked. We made plans to meet a week later at the mining office. She liked the idea, especially after I told her how it had been my hangout since I was a kid. She knew all about the place. It had already been abandoned when she was a kid, but there were still cool things in it back then, like ledgers noting tons of coal shipped and yellowed receipts for mining equipment, and old Mountain Dew bottles with a barefoot hillbilly on them, and the slogan, "It'll tickle your innards." Even a pair of work gloves and an old metal lunch bucket like my grandpa used to have. They had to use metal because the tunnels were so damp, a lunch in a paper bag would be soaked by the time they sat down to eat it. I asked him once what was the worst thing about the mines, the dark, the cold and damp, the claustrophobia, the poison gases, the dust from blasting, the fear of explosions or cave-ins or flooding. He said management. I didn't take care of Misty right away like I said I would. I had to avoid thinking about her for a while, the same way the wife of a wounded soldier had to shut out the first time she witnessed him strap a fake leg onto his stump. I took care of the real estate taxes instead. I paid them early, in person, in cash. The courthouse clerk who gave me my receipt said she wished her son was more like me. I had to drive past Yee's on my way home, so I stopped and got Jody a surprise umbrella and fortune cookie, even though I would be having my appointment with Betty the next day. My intentions were good, but my hunger was stronger, and I ended up eating the cookie. The fortune said, "The bold man is free from fear, but the virtuous man is free from anxieties." I decided to add Confucius to my list of dead people I'd like to meet. It was up to 4 now. I kept my head full of pointless thoughts, like my dead list, to help keep my mind off the family shit constantly crossing my Earth's orbit. But sometimes I had too many pointless thoughts and they came too fast, and I couldn't get my brain to shut down at night so I could sleep. It got so bad I found myself longing for the good night's sleep I'd get after getting fucked as much as I longed for the fuck. We both decided to walk there. Callie didn't have a choice. Driving off in the middle of the night would have been too hard to explain to her husband if she got caught. I didn't want to have to explain to Amber either. She wasn't buying into my nowhere excuse anymore. We would be coming from opposite directions, so we didn't plan to meet and walk together. She assured me she'd be fine walking through the woods by herself, even though I didn't ask her. They were the same woods she used to hang out in with her grandpa, and she knew them like the back of her hand, she told me. And once she hit the tracks, she couldn't get lost. I got there first and waited. I even started to worry about her. I knew there weren't any animals around that could hurt her. Bud's rabid skunk would be dead by now. But I couldn't help thinking about Amber's psychos. I took a walk down the tracks looking for her. About a half mile away from the office was the mine it serviced, a small single shaft one with an entrance no bigger than an attic trap door. Now it was almost completely blocked off by rocks and weeds and fallen metal support beams. Across the tracks stood the tipple that used to sort and load the coal into the train cars. All I could see at night was the tallest section of the splintered wood skeleton, jutting out from the treetops 30 feet above me like the rotting head of a dinosaur. The rest of it, the 100-pound gears, the massive iron funnel, the chutes and rollers and sorting screens, were all brittle with age and coated in blood-brown rust. The companies never tore down the tipples or closed off the shafts when they bugged out. They just left them there the same way people threw garbage on the side of the road. Moms always told their kids to stay away from them, and kids always ignored them, but after a couple times crawling around one and getting your hands and knees full of splinters and rust flakes, the thrill was gone. Skip tried to figure out a way to kill Donnie on the tipple, but there were so many ways for him to accidentally get killed it took all the fun out of planning his death. The mine was a different story. We came up with a plan to lure him inside it with snack cakes, then plant some cherry bombs around the shaft opening, explode them, and cause a cave-in. I didn't think it would work because I couldn't imagine anyone brave or stupid or hungry enough to allow himself to be swallowed up by a black hole in the ground. But as I watched a grinning Skip toss individually wrapped Hostess fruit pies into the shaft, and Donnie obediently follow them, I realized those reasons didn't have anything to do with it. I finally understood Donnie. He endured the indignity and the fear because it made Skip happy. We didn't get to light the cherry bombs. I dropped the matches in a ditch of standing water, and Skip bitched me out for days about what a fuck-up I was. I never bothered telling him I did it on purpose. I gave up and walked back to the office. I was thinking about leaving, even though I knew I wouldn't, when I heard gravel crunching. I went to the door and she was coming up the tracks carrying a backpack and a little Playmate cooler. She unpacked a blanket, a couple roast beef sandwiches, 4 beers, a flashlight, mosquito repellent, matches to start a fire, and stuff to make s'mores. There were some definite advantages to screwing a mom. She asked me how my week went, and I told her fine. I apologized for the condition of the place since I was the guy, and I had asked her to meet me here. She said she didn't mind. She said she loved the calm of decay and desertion that reigned there. And I told her she sounded like Shakespeare. She smiled and asked me what I had read of his, and I said nothing, but I knew how he talked. "Stand over there," she told me. I could hardly see her in the dark, but I saw the blanket being snapped and floating down to the floor. "Don't you want me to sweep out the place?" I asked her. "There's all kinds of shit on the floor, even glass." "I don't mind," she said. She didn't waste any time. She came right at me and pushed Dad's coat off my shoulders and down my arms. When she touched the coat, my instinct was to grab a handful of her hair and smash her head into a wall so hard it would break her neck and crack open her skull. I could cover her shattered face with the blanket, and if I fucked her fast enough, she would still be warm. But warm wasn't good enough. I wanted to make her come again. Feeling her do that was almost as good as the rest of it. I took a deep breath and let the coat fall off my arms onto the floor with a dead thud. She pulled my t-shirt out of my jeans and over my head and kissed me on my mouth and my neck. Then she stepped back and stripped. I still could hardly see her. She was just a pale form without details, like someone had cut the shape of a perfect woman out of a piece of black fabric. I went for her and knocked her down.
We hit the floor kind of hard. I should have asked her if she was okay, but I already had my hands on her ass and a nipple in my mouth.
She made a groan that could have meant she was hurt, but then I felt her hands in my jeans and knew she was functioning.
Lie on your back, she told me.
Huh?
Roll over.
I did, and she straddled my chest.
I want to ask you something, and I want you to be honest with me. I don't care what you say. There's no right or wrong answer.
Jesus Christ, I thought to myself. She was talking in complete sentences.
Sure, I panted. Was I your first? Huh? Was I your first?
First what?
Woman.
Huh? She slid a little lower and leaned over until her breasts were in my face. She stuck her tongue in my ear, then whispered,
Was I the first woman you ever had sex with?
I wasn't in any condition to try and figure out what I should have told her. All I heard was a question, and I answered it. She sat up on my chest again. I couldn't see her face in the dark. I ran my hands all over her body while she talked some more.
I wasn't sure. I thought maybe I was, but you are 19. I didn't think about it until after it happened. I'm sorry your first time was in the mud. I hope it was still memorable. Was it?
I remember it, I said. I felt her get off me. She kissed my mouth and neck again, and my chest and stomach. Each time she kissed my stomach, I felt her breath near my dick. I dug my fingers into the rotting floorboards and prayed to God to let it happen. I didn't even care that I was praying for something perverted, that I was breaking commandments, that he was probably pissed at me because I never prayed for Daddy's soul or Mommy's soul or any of our souls anymore. But now I was praying for this. I prayed harder than I did to shut up Brandy Crow. I prayed harder than I used to pray every night for my dad to love me. She stopped kissing me.
Harley? I heard her voice come from the darkness. Has anyone ever given you head?
The question alone almost made me lose it. I tried thinking about disgusting things to help me hang on. Rick's fat ass waddling out of ShopRite. Mike Jr. running for a touchdown. Betty's thighs in a short skirt.
No,
I answered.
Would you like me to?
Sure.
She took me in her mouth, and at that instant, I believed in God again. I had been doubting his existence ever since my mom killed my dad. Not because of what it did to me, but what it did to the girls. I couldn't believe he would hurt innocence. I knew God wasn't merciful. I knew he wasn't reasonable or farsighted. But I never thought he was a bully. I decided I'd rather not believe in him at all than believe in that. But now I knew he was out there, and he was good and kind. He had given me her, and she was the answer. If every man had her, there would be no wars, no crime, no contact sports. I was still in her mouth when I fell asleep. She was gone when I woke up. I probably should have expected it. She left me a note this time, 2 beers and a sandwich. She said I was sleeping so soundly she didn't want to wake me, but she had to get home and it was a long walk. She'd meet me here next Wednesday. Every bone in my body ached from lying on the wood floor, and my hands were on fire from digging them into the splintered boards. Everything bothered me all of a sudden. The night was too cool. The night was too dark. I had a 3-mile walk ahead of me, a lot of it through the woods. But she bothered me most of all. I wanted her to suck me again. I wanted to make s'mores. I wanted a rolling rock, and she had brought me a Miller in a can. I put my clothes on and took my beers and sandwich outside to eat. She had left me a flashlight, too. I sat in the middle of the rusted tracks and stared down the length of them, wondering where they really did end up. It wasn't California.
I bet they just stopped somewhere in a field of junk metal.
A noise cracked in the woods behind me. I jerked my head around. Callie? I called softly. I flicked on the flashlight and swept the trees, hoping to catch a velvet-eyed deer in the beam. Nothing. I turned it off. Then I heard a rustle. It sounded too big to be a skunk, too clumsy to be a deer, too hurried to be a coon, too decisive to be a dog. Then one of the trees shook with a hiss and a human scream. I fumbled with the light, but before I could turn it on again, a ghostly figure escaped from its branches and took off flying. It let out one more scream and turned its pale, heart-shaped face downward as it passed overhead. A barn owl, I thought with relief. An owl that doesn't hoot. I went back to eating, forgetting for the moment that there was something out there. It hadn't been the owl. Whatever surprised me the first time had been tragically earthbound.
Chapter 13. Betty was very friendly when I got there, probably because our last appointment had ended with me freaking out and she didn't expect to see me for a while. I slumped onto the end of the couch, stared out the window, and only gave her grunts and shrugs for the first half hour. The parking lot was busy with people going in and out of the DMV. A lot of people were going in and out of behavioral services, too. Most of them women. Must have been the summer rush. They were all psychologically traumatized by the thought of putting on their bathing suits. They should have been, too. They were cows. Except for one. She was good-looking, wearing white shorts and a black t-shirt. She had nice legs and shiny gold hair like Jody. She already had a tan. I watched her come out of the building and walk to her car, a brand-new dark green Camaro. I wondered what her problem was. Fear of heights? Fear of breaking a nail? Fear of Walmart? Maybe she was getting fed up with the characters on her favorite soap opera. I didn't know her, but I hated her. I didn't even care that she was hot. If she'd come on to me, I would have thrown up. I only wanted Callie. I couldn't figure out if I loved Callie, though. I thought about her all the time. Most of it was about fucking her. But some of it was about how she made me feel just talking to me, or looking at me. Not special or impressive or needed. Accepted, maybe. She was one more thing that was wrong with me that I liked about me anyway. I watched the woman stop at her car door and fish for her keys in her purse. She had a nice rear end, but it was nothing compared to Callie's. Hers could have been an altar. Harley, did you hear what I said? Lately, I had started thinking about marrying her, what that kind of life would be like. Sex every day, blowjobs on my lunch hour, someone to cook and clean and care for me. It didn't matter if I loved her. From what I had seen of marriage, the woman had to love the man, but the man only had to love what the woman did for him. Harley. I wasn't going to make it until Wednesday. Maybe I didn't have to. I didn't have to be married to her to go visit her on my lunch break. I could do it tomorrow. Harley, are you in there? She could blow me in my truck. Fingers snapped in front of my face. I swiped at them before I realized what they were. Betty drew her hand back. I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to upset you. I'm not upset. She edged back in her chair, uncrossed her legs and recrossed them the other way, then fixed her skirt. It was a short one today, just my luck. Mint green with white flowers on it, all pleated like a window blind. Did you find that woman attractive? She asked me. What woman? The one you were staring at so intently. I wasn't staring at her. The veins on Betty's legs looked like scribbling to me. They could have come in handy being a shrink. Her patients could have read her thighs instead of ink blots. All right, you weren't staring at her, she said to humor me. But you did notice her. Did you find her attractive? I pulled the brim of my cap down over my eyes. Nope. Why not? I just didn't. I thought she was attractive. Then I guess you're sorry she left. She had a big purple twist on her right thigh that the hem of her skirt didn't cover. I studied it. I saw spaghetti. I saw a pile of night crawlers. I saw a baby strangling in its umbilical cord. Come on, Harley, she urged. Treat me like I'm a person, not your therapist. We're just two people hanging out talking. I thought she was attractive. You didn't. Why not? She had a tan. You don't like tans?
It's only the last week of May. A tan that good means she just got back from a vacation, or she goes to a tanning place.
And I take it you don't approve of either? It means she's rich or stuck on herself. I see. And you don't feel you're making broad assumptions and generalizations?
Yeah, I am. I saw the Monongahela, Susquehanna, and Allegheny Rivers meeting on a road map.
Do you think that's fair to her? I shrugged. Would it be fair to you for someone to look at the way you're dressed and assume you're a redneck? I almost laughed at her saying the word redneck. She said it like it was two words, like she could have replaced red with blue or green, and it would have meant the same thing to her.
Would that bother you?
No.
But is that a fair summation of your character? Are you a redneck?
It doesn't matter, I told her. People have to judge other people by the way they look. We don't have a choice. We can't smell personalities the way dogs can. She smiled at me. I dropped my gaze from her face and fixed it back on her leg. I saw groundhog guts.
True, but we can talk to each other, she said. Wouldn't that be a better way to judge someone?
I turned back to the window, scowling. Her pen eraser started tapping on her notepad. I wished I had the balls to take it and stab it in her eye.
What do you find physically attractive in a woman?
What kind of question is that?
Just a question.
Her body, I answered.
What about her body?
That it's a woman's body.
No, I mean specifically.
That's it.
So you like any female body? You don't care if it's overweight or elderly or...
No, I interrupted, shaking my head at a mental picture of all the ShopRite customers shopping naked. I mean if she's got a good body. I don't care about one part more than the others.
What if you had to choose one part? What would it be?
I looked over at her. She was leaning forward, waiting for my response. I thought she might be turning kinky on me, but then I remembered an article I had read once in a woman's magazine in the waiting room at Mom's prison about how men revealed a lot about themselves by what body part they liked best. The article used nicer words, but basically it said men who were obsessed with asses, even female ones, were closet fags. Men who were obsessed with breasts lusted for their mothers. Men who were obsessed with women's legs wished they could be women themselves. No men were obsessed with pussies because we were actually afraid of them. Betty had probably read the same article. It was probably a chapter in one of the books at her real office. Her mouth, I said.
Her mouth?
She repeated, surprised. Can we stop talking about this crap? I blurted it out. I don't want to talk about crap.
Fine, Harley. What do you want to talk about?
I knew you were going to say that.
It's your session, not mine.
It's the state of Pennsylvania's session, I said angrily. Don't they give you guidelines about what we're supposed to talk about?
She leaned back in her chair and contemplated me. In a sense they do, but I'm willing to bet you don't want to talk about any of that either.
My scalp was sweating. I took off my hat and set it on the table next to the box of Kleenex. It was the first time I had taken my hands out of my coat pockets.
What happened to your hands? Betty gasped. They look like you put them through glass.
I glanced down at them. Misty's scratches had faded, but the palms were a mess. I got a bunch of splinters, I explained. I guess I didn't do a very good job digging them out.
Splinters? What were you doing?
I thought about it. Ripping up floorboards, I answered.
Did you put something on them so they won't get infected?
They're okay, I said. She couldn't stop looking at them, so I put them back in Dad's pockets. Then she kept glancing at my pockets. She was making me nervous. I was ready for her to go to the desk and whip out a first aid kit. Would it be a cheap plastic one like the one Mom kept in the medicine cabinet? Or would it be a chocolate leather doctor's bag to match her date book? Okay, there's something I want to talk about, I said to get her mind off my hands. She gave me a pleased look of surprise like she had discovered a bud on a plant she expected to die.
Go on, she said.
How can a kid like someone who beats them up? You know, how can they like hanging out with them?
Did you like hanging out with your father? She asked.
I never hung out with my dad. He didn't like me. A big flock of me exploded in front of my eyes. They rose up from Betty's lap and fluttered around the room like butterflies. I tried keeping track of them, bobbing my head and blinking, but there were too many. "This isn't about me," I went on, watching them zip around the room. "I just want to know, as a broad assumption or generalization, how it can happen."
"Well," she began, tapping her pen on her forehead twice. "Every child reacts to abuse differently. Some become withdrawn, some openly hostile, some self-destructive, but some embrace the abuse. They thrive on it. It's what they get from their abusive parent instead of love, and they come to need it."
"So you're saying a kid can actually want to get hit?
In a sense?
Can they start to think that it's okay? Morally okay?
Did you think it was okay for your father to hit you?"
"This isn't about me," I stressed again.
"You can still answer the question."
I let out a shaky breath. I didn't want to lose it. I didn't want Betty running off to get me a styrofoam cup of water. I didn't want to have a breakthrough. I wanted it to be lunchtime tomorrow. "I didn't think it was okay," I said bluntly. "But I thought it was normal." I could tell she was going to ask me to explain my comment further, so I rushed ahead with another question. It was a hard one to ask. I had to concentrate on something else and let my voice say the words without me understanding them. "What about sexually abused kids?" I watched one me after another land on the windowsill, all packed together, making a colorful cluster like feathers in an Indian headdress. "Can they think that it's okay?"
"Okay, but not normal?" Betty asked.
"No," I shook my head in frustration. "Can they think it's normal? Can they think it's right?"
"Are you talking about Misty?"
Her question hit me like a sucker punch. I struggled to find my voice and then control it. "What do you know about Misty?"
"Very little, since I treated her for such a short time," she replied, frowning.
Misty and Jody dropping out of therapy was a sore spot with Betty, but it got too hard. I couldn't get time off work to drive them to their appointments, plus they both hated going. Misty used to disappear into the woods, and I used to have to carry Jody kicking and screaming to the truck. Amber wanted to go to her sessions. She even made arrangements with friends to drive her and pick her up afterward. Betty went on.
"But in the few sessions we had, I did get the feeling Misty believed your father's abuse toward all of you was warranted. She felt it was right, if you want to call it that."
I fell silent, and Betty tapped her pen on her notepad.
"Who was sexually abused, Harley?"
she asked with the detachment of a person filling out a form. "None of us," I answered, startled.
"What about Amber?"
"Amber?" My throat clamped shut the way it used to when I saw Dad listening to Mom's Day. "They were never alone," I protested. "When she was home, she made sure someone else was always in the room with her. She was terrified of Dad. She hated him."
"What about at night?"
"Amber hated him," I said again, ignoring her question.
"Did she?"
"Yeah," I answered, amazed she could even ask.
"How do you know? Have you ever talked to her about it?"
"I don't have to talk to her. I was always there when he hit her. I saw."
"How did you feel toward your father when he hit Amber?"
Tears filled my eyes. I couldn't figure out where they had come from. I felt sorry for him. Betty moved forward in her chair.
"You felt sorry for your father, not Amber?"
I nodded.
"How did you feel toward Amber?"
"What do you mean?"
"Did you get mad at her? Did you think she deserved it? Did you want to help her?"
"I wanted to make her feel better."
"How do you think she felt when she saw your father hit you?"
"I don't know." Her questions felt like rocks being thrown at my head. I covered my face with my mangled hands. The salt from my tears stung the gouges I'd made with my pocket knife. "She probably didn't like it," I cried into them.
"Do you think she wanted to make you feel better?"
6 seconds. The scientist on TV had said the sky would light up like 1,000 suns, and by the time we turned to look at it, it would have hit with the power of 10,000 Hiroshima bombs. I saw it coming, rushing at me. my head filled with a harsh, white light obliterating the image behind it. I didn't have a chance to recognize it, to know if it was a memory or a dream. I was blind, but I could feel. Amber, her soft weight against me, her surrender, the smell of watermelon lip smacker. It hit before I could figure it all out. I came to huddled on the floor, trembling and sobbing, but I had survived. And like any survivor of a doomsday strike, I thought I was lucky. No one could have convinced me that I would have been better off dying instantly. Betty was kneeling in front of me.
I couldn't make out her face through my tears, but I saw her young eyes. I saw her whole young life in them.
She was glad she was old now. She was relieved. I felt her hands on my arm.
It's all right, Harley.
Did Dad have 6 seconds? He didn't know it was coming. Mom snuck up behind him and let him have it. She didn't have a choice. It was a big gun. She couldn't have whipped it out and surprised him. She couldn't have faced him down either. If she had tried, she would have stood there with the gun shaking in her hands, and he would have walked right up to her and taken it from her like it was one more bill they couldn't pay.
It's all right, she said again.
I got up from the floor and stumbled blindly around the room looking for my hat and a me.
Harley, please calm down. Don't go rushing off again.
I grabbed my hat off the table. I couldn't find a single me.
You need to talk about this.
No, I don't, I cried.
It will make you feel better.
I don't want to feel better. I bolted for the door.
Please don't go, Harley,
she called after me. But I was gone, and this time I knew better than to look back. Yee's had 3 customers, the busiest I had ever seen it. Jack Yee didn't look as glad to see me as he usually did. The customers didn't look too glad either. Jack's wife glanced up from her newspaper, then buried her face in it again without waving.
I ordered Misty's egg roll and got myself an order of General So's chicken.
I was supposed to be saving money. I still needed $100 to finish paying our taxes, but I couldn't shake the doomsday feeling I had had in Betty's office. Every meal could be my last, and I didn't want it to be hot dogs and mac and cheese. Jack Yee went back in the kitchen and packed up the order himself. I had to ask him for Jody's fortune cookie and umbrella. On my way out, I checked myself in the front door glass to see what everyone had been staring at. I could have used a shower and a shave and a good night's sleep, but other than that, I was still me. I got back in my truck and ripped into the chicken box right away. He had given me 6 plastic forks, 3 sets of chopsticks, and about 20 packets of soy sauce and sweet and sour sauce. I could almost smell his nervousness in the greasy-bottomed bag. The chicken was good, but not great. I was sure Callie could do better if I was married to her. She would cook for me all the time, too. I finished eating and crushed the box before tossing it on the floor. It bounced off the Chicago Art Institute book and landed next to Mom and Dad's wedding picture. I had never thought about it before, but it was pretty pathetic if that was the best photo they had from their wedding. Mom sick because she was pregnant with me. Dad falling down drunk because she was pregnant with me. I'd always assumed Dad was grinning at a buddy. Now I wondered if it was Uncle Mike, and Uncle Mike already knew it was a bad idea. Or was he looking at Grandpa? Was he saying, "Look at me, you nasty old cocksucker. I got a job and a wife, and you were always telling me I'd never get either." I was going to keep the picture buried there in the trash for the rest of my life. It was too fucking symbolic to mess with. I took my time driving. I wasn't in any hurry now that I had a full stomach, and I definitely didn't feel like seeing the girls. I hadn't seen any of them that morning. I didn't get home from the mining office until 5. Elvis went nuts in the front of my truck where I had locked him, so his barking wouldn't wake them when I left and when I got back. I let him out, gave him a good scratching, and took him inside with me. We shared the leftover sloppy Joe meat Amber had left sitting out on the stove from the night before. I didn't even bother trying to catch an hour or two of sleep. I went for a drive and counted Madonnas. They looked best at breaking dawn, gazing peacefully at the dew-soaked grass around their feet. They were always surrounded by a bunch of crap, ceramic deer with chipped noses, bird baths, lawn jockeys, a kaleidoscope of reflecting balls, ducks with windmill wings, wooden cutouts of women bending over showing their underwear.
but they always seemed to be standing alone.
I counted 7. The only old-fashioned plastic one belonged to the Shanks.
On the way home from Yee's, I slowed in front of their house like I had done in the morning and admired her sky-blue robes and petal-pink lips. She was the only one of the Madonnas who had the nerve to look up at God, and she was happy with him. Her smile